I think it's a Shiloh halacha, which I always really wanted to ask Rav Lichtenstein, whether you stand for a somebody who's an expert in the humanities. The Rishonim would probably say you don't, right? I don't know. I know Rav Lichtenstein says the Torah Mada extends even to the humanities, right? It's a chiddush. Why are we talking about Torah Mada? Well, I'll tell you, I know it's a very controversial subject, Torah Mada, but I'll tell you one group who are really opposed to it. I'm not talking about the Haredim. The Greeks. The Greeks were against Torah Mada. No? In Achanami, right? We may have the opportunity to discuss that tonight. The title of my talk, did you guys all have source sheets? Excellent. It's nice to see so much energy at 7 o'clock at night. Fabulous. Just, watch your arm. You don't want to pull something. It's going to want it to be too strenuous, this lecture. So what's the title of this lecture? You guys can hear. How are the acoustics here? Good? Seeing is believing. So do we believe that? I mean, we'll get to it, but do we believe it?
No.
This is... No. No, we don't believe that. Any Americans in the room? Anybody born since 1607? Yes. I mean, I think we're, aren't we all, we're all part of this tradition that goes back to, I love coming to YU, I haven't come here before, but I've spoken at YU in New York, and it's just, I can always count on a YU audience being receptive and alive to the references that I make, not only in Torah, but also in Mada, right? So, of course, aren't we all part of the tradition that starts with Francis Bacon and Thomas Hobbes and John Locke? I mean, we're empiricists, aren't we? What's an empiricist, by the way? What? I'll work with whatever you're offering over here. Listen, give me something here.
It's a guy.
That's just very, very little, actually. Come on, what's an empiricist? Guys. There you go.
Somebody works with data.
You're an adult. We have somebody back there. I'm sorry. Excuse me. I know you're all adults. I came from Bar Ilan. No, I know you are. I'm struck by the maturity of the audience. Yes.
I was going to say
research backed by data. I'm in the humanities. What do I have data? They don't give me like petri dishes when I come into the university. But you mean really? Come on. Give me data is a really a more modern term. An empiricist is somebody who studies experience, right? Who learns about the world through experience. We certainly all put ourselves in that category, don't we?
Not yet.
Yeah. I mean, in that sense, I grew up as an American. I still think I am. I miss Thanksgiving. Seeing is believing. But we'll maybe explore that in relationship to the Greeks to see to what extent we do believe that. I want to talk tonight about a few things. To start out with, I was on the way here. I was looking at the Or Gedaliah. So maybe just one question that I'll throw out to make it a little bit new for me. The Or Gedaliah says there are four kingdoms, right? The Chazal break down world history historiographically into these four kingdoms. Of course, they understand it's more complex, but there are these four kingdoms. What are they? Excellent. So Persia, Babel, Yavan, and Edom. Excellent. So Or Gedaliah says that each one of the major transgressions, what are those three major transgressions? Gilearias, Shichas Damim, Nevodah Zarah, is associated with one of the first three, and in Edom we have this horrible mixture of all of them. And he associates, interestingly, the avera that goes with Yavan is Shichas Damim. Seems kind of odd, doesn't it? And counterintuitive. Why is it counterintuitive and odd? Let's just hear the question. I don't know if we're going to answer it right away. Why is it odd?
They were hedonists.
Pardon? They were hedonists? Who were hedonists?
The Greeks.
What's a hedonist? A hedonist. What's a hedonist? You're better read than spoken, yes? What's a hedonist?
People who seek pleasure.
People who seek pleasure. Is that mutter, actually? Rabbi? Well, you'll invite me back for that, okay? That's another discussion. But you mean this excess desire for pleasure and the pleasures of the body. Yeah, I mean, okay, but why is that?
That's more Gilearias than Shvichas Damim.
Ah, so you would have said, let's nominate something else. And Shvichas Damim seems strange for many reasons. The Greek exiles, we'll talk, was really not distinguished by loss of life, right? And we'll maybe get to that. But So tonight we'll talk, we'll start with the Rambam, we'll talk a little bit about what the Hanukkah lights represent, then we'll talk maybe about the Geder of Yavon. What are the parameters of Galus Yavon? How is it different? This really gets to your comment. How is it different than the other Galuses? And finally, we'll talk a little bit about the Gezeres, whatever decrees the Greeks used in order to fight the war against the Jews, or their particular kind of war against the Jews. Let's start with the Rambam, shall we? Yeah? A little halacha. Can I have a nominee to read for us? I was just teaching, I'm embarrassed to say, I was teaching at Bar-Ilan today, Oedipus Rex. How can a nice, firm person like me teach Oedipus Rex on Hanukkah? Right? I'm teaching the Greeks on Hanukkah. I said, the Greeks are upon me. So, Baruch Hashem, here we are. Somebody please. Nobody hesitated to volunteer for Oedipus. That's why I thought of it. So, good. You're sitting in the back. What's your name? Pardon? Let's see out. In a loud voice, yeah? An appropriate name, yeah? So, the Rambam, please. Yeah. Not the first one. We'll skip. Should we skip... Rabbi, you'll forgive me, I brought in, I think this is the first time Rabbi Kaufman pointed out to me that I'm bringing a source from the disciple Paul, who says there is neither Greek nor Jew. That's a Hanukkah inyan, isn't it? So you'll forgive this, the provenance of the source. And we'll skip Mendelssohn for the moment, and we'll go right to Matisyahu and the Rambam. You're on. They're not really numbers there, but the Rambam, yeah? From the third or fourth selection on the sheet. Excellent. Okay, let can we just go a little slower and let's feel the poetry of the Rambam. Is the Rambam often referred to as a poet? Not really. Why not? Just the straightforward what? The halacha. Just the halacha, just the din. Why else don't we think of him as a poet? Yeah.
Because he doesn't utilize line breaks.
He doesn't utilize line breaks.
It's prose, it's not.
But prose can be poetic, can't it be?
Yeah, but...
I mean, you know, if you've read any John Milton, right, you know that his prose can be as poetic as his poetry. But it doesn't evidence, I could see I'm going to have a tough audience here, it doesn't evidence the formal attributes of poetry. Right, but it's. Can we read that again, Matisyahu? A little bit more poetically, yeah. I don't know. You don't have to sing. Okay, let's just. I think we would put a natural pause there, right? Mitzvah Ner Chanukah, Mitzvah Chavivihi Ad Ma'od. Now, what is there anything? If you were a freshman composition teacher, and you had the Rambam in your class. You'll have to deal with whatever the psychological relationship that that entails. You have the Rambam in class, and he gives you the sentence. What do you say then? I mean, you say, wow, you're the Rambam. But what do you say about the sentence? What do you mean, no kidding? I mean, let's look at the language carefully here. I mean, I thought the Rambam, you were saying he not only gives you the straight halach, he's a rationalist. As your YU guys, right? The Rambam is a super rationalist. That's what we say in the Jewish Studies Department at Bar-Ilan. So what's kind of unusual about this?
He's talking about an emotional life.
Where do I see evidence of emotion here?
Chavivi
ad ma'od. I mean, the first thing I tell my freshman students is no adjectives and no adverbs. The Rambam is throwing an adverb at me. Mitzvah chavivi ad ma'od, why? I mean, it is unusual. It's unusual that the Rambam is saying that the mitzvah is chaviv. It seems like the Rambam is really abandoning his rationalism, and he's kind of enthusiastic. I don't know how your Hebrew is. I assume it's probably as good as mine. My kids, from time to time, will, if one of them gets overly excited about something, one will say to the other in a kind of sarcastic tone, "Lam ata kol kach mitlahev." You ever hear that expression? No? Lam ata kol kach mitlahev. What does it mean literally? Literally, why are you getting so excited? It's the way, you know, one kid tries to deflate the enthusiasm of another. If you just look at the etymology of that word, what's mitlahev? What's hiding there? It's kind of interesting philology. Hitlavut, right? Hitlavut is enthusiasm, is to get lit up. So the question is, why is the Rambam getting all lit up about Hanukkah? It really is. It really is. You don't like that? It really is. It really is, whether you like it or not, it really is a kind of extraordinary sense in which the Rambam is kind of jumping up and down. The doubling of mitzvah, chavivihi, ad ma'od. So Matisyahu, can you continue for us, please? You don't have to, you can stop singing now, right? We're getting to the halacha part, yeah? Right, there's really a lot to do with this Rambam, and I don't know if we'll have the occasion to think about it all together. And the Rambam seems to have a problem not only with adverbs and adjectives, also with number. Is it nes or nisim? Right? Is it nes or nisim? Which one is it? Right, he starts out by talking hanes, and then lehosif b'shevach hakel v'hodiyah lo ala nisim. Which one is it? Made a mistake? Probably not, right? And what is this din here? If you don't have money for Hanukkah candles, what do? Sell your stuff. Where does Rambam get that? Is that a Gemara? I'm just wondering, where does he get that din from?
Oh, I think it's based off the same mission that we have for Arvish Sachem about Arvichosis.
So this isn't in Chazal. And this is a Chiddush in the Rambam, and the Magen Mishnah says what you were saying. That so how does he learn from Arvichosis? What's the relationship between the two? So both are persume nisim, and the Rambam learns out from Arba Kosos where I'm obligated to sell my stuff in order to be mfarsim the nes of Pesach, so also by the Ner Chanukah. Sell my stuff, sell my coat. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what the lights of Chanukah are. So can we have some other volunteers, maybe somebody a little closer up in the room to read some sukim, and maybe some rishonim. Hello? Yeah, what's your name?
Gedi.
I'm sorry?
Gedi Hirshan.
Gedi, okay.
Yeah, so
first the pasuk from Bamidbar.
Okay.
I get to do the English. I'm the English professor, right? Speak unto Aaron and say unto him, when thou lightest the lamp. So forgive me, I don't think I'm using Art Scroll or Feldheim. I'm using King James. Speak unto Aaron and say unto him, when they're good, you know. When thou lightest the lamps, the seven lamps shall give light over the candlestick. They lose a little bit with that, with the narrows. So what are these in the book Kapashtis? What is this pasuk talking about? Pardon? Yeah, but what does Rashi say? If you recall on the spot, what does Rashi say? We know that Aaron is coming along and saying, you know, we have no inheritance. We want something. And I think the way Rashi learns is this is the service of the Beis HaMikdash. This is what you get. Now, we'll just see a little kind of a constellation of different Rishonim. We saw the Rambam. We'll see the Ramban in a second. But first, a Medrash. And Gedi?
Yeah.
Gedi.
Gedi, yeah.
Gedi, can you continue? Can you read the Tanchuma for us?
Okay.
So this is like a dialogue between God and Klal Yisrael. And I think this is God talking, Kodesh Baruch Hu talking to Klal Yisrael.
Okay.
I think Anu Bo'orech.
Okay, Anu Bo'orech Nira Or.
So how do we really have to read that B'tmiyah, right? We live in your light. Va'ata Omer Lahadlik Neros. So what does Rabbi Meir say?
Okay, so what does Rabbi Meir say? So Amar Rabbi Meir, Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu, Chaviv Alai Neros She'arim Lamdik, Mina Me'arot She'kavati Hashemar.
So first of all, we may have an origin for the Rambam's Lashon of Chaviv, right? Maybe it comes from this Medrash. And the Medrash is suggesting that these lights, whatever they are, and we haven't identified for sure what they are, these lights, whatever they are more precious to a Kodesh Baruch Hu than the lights in the heaven and the earth. Why would that be? So for Rashi, it's the lights of the Beis HaMikdash. There's another Medrash Tanchuma, which I'll just read the end of it. This is the bold type. Of Al Haneros, Leolam Almul Pnei HaMenorah, V'kol HaBrachu Shenasati Lecha, Levarech es b'nei einun b'teilin le'oilam. So this is on a similar theme. We're talking about these similar lights. And what's distinctive about these lights? That they were never, ever be mevatel. Now the Ramban comes along and learns, I didn't bring the Ramban, but I'll read the English. The intention of this homiletic text is to derive an allusion from this section of the Torah to the Chanukah of lights, which occurred in the period of Bayit Sheni, through Aaron and his sons, namely the Chashmonai. And I have gone further, and the Medrash Rabbah, the Holy One, blessed be He, said to Moses, go and tell Aaron, fear not, you are designated for something of greater importance to me than this. The offerings are brought only as long as the sanctuary is in existence. But the lamps will give light in front of the menorah forever, and all the blessings with which to bless my children will never come to an end. What's the diuk of the Ramban? How is he learning different than Rashi? Rashi's learning that these lights are the lights of the Beit HaMikdash. What is the Ramban learning? Pardon? The menorahs that we light nowadays. What's the license that he gets to say that? He needs some kind of license to do this, right? I mean, when you're in the university, which is a very different kind of environment, and any lecture on Chanukah is always already a Torah Madashir, when you're in the university, sometimes it feels like just anything can go, right? And you read a poem and one person will say one thing and somebody else will say another thing. And the whole idea of empirical evidence and data sometimes goes entirely out the window. You guys going to university, any of you? Yeah? Really? Oh my gosh. The Greeks, they are upon us. The Greeks in our world, Menayan. Where do we find the Greeks in our world? Heino, the university. What university are you going to? Pardon? Oh, Baruch Hashem, Yeshiva University. Oh, that's different. I mean, in many ways, of course, it obviously is different. Are you going to YU?
No.
No? So, pardon?
Say yes.
You'd prefer not to have this discussion? You're feeling defensive? Not defensive? I don't know. In any event, listen, whenever you're studying the humanities any place, and I don't know all the guys who teach in the humanities, but it's a different ballpark, a different way of thinking. You know, Rav Aaron's article, fantastic piece on Torah Mada in the volume edited by J.J. Schefter. You know that piece? Fantastic. Amazing. But the only problem with it, and he's like 100%, not, he's very careful, as always, but he really gives a very strong argument for Torah Mada. And I just had like two, well, slight digression here, two, I think, major criticisms. And one is that not every university, even Yeshiva University in 2011, is like Harvard in 1959, right? University culture has changed big time. Did they have Facebook in 1959? No. And the other big argument against Rav Aaron is not everybody is Rav Aaron. In fact, nobody else is Rav Aaron. Meaning he could get his dissertation, but I got my PhD at Columbia, I worked on my dissertation like 12 to 15 hours a day. Rav Aaron was in the base medrash 12 to 15 hours a day, right?
Can I make a comment?
Yes, you may. Pardon?
I was with Rav Aaron together.
Okay.
And when he studied in executive classes,
yeah.
He sat in the back and learned Gemara.
So even more. Right.
And he got straight A's.
You know, okay, so there you go. And thank you. I mean, you're hurting my self-esteem here. I mean, I before I came tonight, I thought I was a pretty smart guy. Columbia, Oxford, I did pretty well. But I had to work pretty hard for it. So, I mean, that's a big time against Torah Mada, right? Because Rav Aaron could pull it off. You know, it's a little harder for some of the rest of us to pull it off. Anyway, where were we? Oh, yeah. If we were in the license, what's the Ramban's license? I mean, sometimes in university, it doesn't seem like you need a license for anything. What's the license the Ramban says to say it's the Chashmonai? It's nice. He likes it. Makes people feel good. And it'll make nice for, you know, be a nice art scroll story about it. Is that what's the license? Somebody said it before. You said it, no? Or you said it? Hello? The license in the Medrash.
Forever?
Le'olam, right? They'll never be mevato. So the Ramban goes on and says, we know there was Chorban Beit HaMikdash. Can't be that. It's good kasha on Rashi, how Rashi is going to answer. These lights, which will never go out, the Ramban takes that seriously. Never. We have them now. The Ramban says the lights that Kodesh Baruch Hu finds so precious are the lights of the Hanukkah menorah. Why is that? Why should these be so precious to us? And now we're kind of building the question, why are they so chaviv to the Ramban, and why are, to the Rambam, and why are they so beloved as well in the Medrash, according to the Ramban? So let's move to our next question. What about Yavan? What is the geder of Yavan? How do we think about them? How is the Galus of Yavan different? You're going to start us off? Yeah. What's your name? We don't. I don't have to. Last names. No way I'm going to remember. Let's go for the first name. Yeah. They were for the advancement of the glorification of man. And we're not for that? No, we're not for that. We're not for that. Let's just put something on the map first. Let's look at this passage from Flavush, I think, Mishnah Brewer brings. And here I'll ask for another reader volunteer, if you will indulge me. Anybody? Anybody hiding in the back? There you go. What's
the
your name?
English right here, Yitzi.
No, from Mishnah Brewer. Where, what is Yavan? So the Shulchan Aruch is talking about the din, that we know that it's really not a mitzvah to eat on Chanukah, which is a big chiddush, right? This is a Jewish holiday in which it's neither a mitzvah to either eat or to fast. The cycle of Jewish holidays being a kind of dialectic between fasting and overeating. But go ahead, yeah? Uh-huh. So Chanukah is a holiday characterized by halal and hoda'ah. So let's just stop here, that in order to get a sense of what Chanukah is, we'll look at Chanukah in relationship to that other rabbinic holiday, Purim. And we'll try to see what the difference is, what the points of contrast are. So please continue. Yeah.
So filo hamiru datam.
Chaz v'shalom.
Chaz v'shalom. Lo hayam v'kabal lo tam l'kach sh'atzivam v'karash baruch hu imenu. Kavu l'halagu u'l'shavuku.
Yisbarach, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, gam ken al yedei mishta.
Yisbarach, gam ken al yedei mishta.
Okay, so how did Purim work? What was the transgression that preceded the miracle of Purim? You guys had dinner already? Yeah? You're beginning to digest your food? Yeah? What was the miracle that preceded the Purim, the Avera, the transgression that preceded the Purim miracle?
The feast?
Yes, yeah, so they transgressed with their bodies, right? They ate too much, right? And as a result of that, what was the threat to them? To their bodies through death, right? Oh, you raise your hand to Haman, say, you know, I'll worship your idols and your gods. What does Haman say? Was your grandfather Jewish? A Moloch, right? Was your grandfather Jewish? You have an aunt that was Jewish? You're out of here. And how do we celebrate on Purim? With our bodies. Can you continue for us now, Chanukah? Masha Einkein.
Masha Einkein, the Masa Dantiopas, Shalot is Azar Alehem, Rob Lashmi, Rak Tzorot, Kish, Ishmadot, Kedela, Amir Datam.
Aha, so what did Antiochus want? What does it mean, Lahamir Datam?
To assimilate?
Yeah, do you have a better translation of that? Yeah, that's what it means, yeah, to assimilate. But we're more literal. Yeah. No, I don't think so. Lamir is to get their das, really, to convert them. I mean, so where in the case of Haman, you say, I'll worship your idols. Haman says, no way. But Antiochus, great. You can become one of us. And that is the phenomenon which is not replicated in any other of the exiles of a Hellenist, right? Is there a corresponding notion of a Hellenist during the Babylonian exile? Is there a Babylist? Is there a Romist? It's also something distinct about Galus Yavan. You have this idea of a Hellenist. We don't have it any other time. So continue for us, please.
On the brackets,
right? Oh, whatever you want. Go for it, yeah.
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 Yeah. Lahem Mas Ozrin Amuratam. Ashalom Lo Hayu Mavakim Yoter.
Okay, so let's talk about now. We spoke about Purim. Now what about Hanukkah? What was the transgression that brought on the miracle of Hanukkah? What corresponds to what we saw by Achashverus, the feast? So we know that the service in the Beit HaMikdash was weakened. The service had weakened. A spiritual service had weakened. So what is the solution to that? So what is the punishment that will follow from that? Not their bodies, but rather their spirits, the neshamas. And when we're rescued from that, how do we celebrate? By eating and drinking? I mean, we know the Maram Rothenberg. I saw this Diuk in the Rav, or the Rav has a Diuk in the Rambam. Hodav Simcha, the Rav says Simcha's Mishta is really eating, whatever. But we know, how do we celebrate on Hanukkah? Halo v'hoda, right? Why? It's the same thing, it's consistent. By Purim, it's all having to do with the body. By Hanukkah, it's all having to do with the nefesh, the neshama. So Antiochus would have been very happy had the Jews assimilated. What bugged Antiochus about the Jews? What's bothering Antiochus? I mean, I asked you before, you know, who is the group that really doesn't believe in Torah Mata? People really don't believe in Torah Mata, the Greeks. Right? You feel the force of that? Why they wouldn't believe in that? What bugs the Greeks? So we spoke about the four kingdoms before. What is Chazal associate each one of the kingdoms with a particular attribute? What do Chazal associate with the Greeks? No. That was the or Gedalia. That's later. That's Achron, right? No, the Chazal I'm talking about. What attribute would you associate with the Greeks from Psukim? What would you say following, you said, for hedonism? I don't know. Some people might say Yofi. How many other nominations? Pardon?
And what is that?
I don't know. Chazal say Chachma, wisdom. I mean, you know. You have to remember here, guys, Chazal have an extremely, I wouldn't say ambivalent relationship to the Greeks, but it's ambiguous. What language is a safer Torah kosher in, aside from Hebrew?
Greek,
right? Sigzeres Akasiv. That's strange, right? Do we believe that there's such a thing as Greek wisdom? I'm not up in Amshinov, in Bayit Vagan, guys. Do we believe in Greek wisdom?
Yeah.
Right? Is this the right address? Do we believe in Greek wisdom?
Yeah.
Yes. If so, but I would have to say, there's a medrash, though. You know, if somebody tells you there's Torah among the nations, what will you tell to them? If somebody says there's Torah among the nations, what do you say to them?
Amen.
Get out of here. If somebody says to you there's wisdom among the nations, yeah. Believe them. And of all the nations in the world, Chazal hold the Greeks in the highest esteem. Absolutely in the highest esteem. So we're not surprised that Chazal associate the Greeks with wisdom. The Maharal comes hundreds of years later, and he says that the characteristic of Greek wisdom, and it's amazing how prescient either the Maharal is or the Maharal's Peirush makes Chazal prescient, that the characteristic of Greek wisdom is that it spreads. We have a term for that, is that Greek wisdom becomes universal. And Chazal knew this, that if you grow up in the West, this is another shir also, perhaps you'll invite me back. If you grow up in the West, everybody thinks like a Greek. Everybody does. I would even say this in Bayit Vagan. We think like Greeks. It's a challenge not to think like Greeks. Hanukkah is a time when we try not to think like Greeks, maybe. So their knowledge spread. As the Maharal says, this is on the bottom of the page 2. The wisdom of the Greeks spread from all sides, the length and breadth of the world, without limits. And for this reason, Yavan did not oppose Israel except for their adherence to Torah. And this was the whole essence of Yavan, to be mevatel Israel's connection to the Torah of Hashem. Why? Why do they want to do that? Why are the Greeks against Torah Mata? They don't like what don't they like about the Torah part?
It's not Greek.
Well, the Greeks are, you know, Paul says there's no Jew, there's no Greek. The Apostle Paul, right? Greek, Jew, there's no difference. They don't mind Jewish wisdom, do they? I mean, let's have, here's the base medrash. What's the Greek parallel to the Greek base medrash? Library. It's just their day. Anybody come visit me, buy me a cup of coffee, National Library, it's great. They're not only, Greek books, they're books from every nationality. Greeks are open-minded, aren't they? Yeah, what were you going to say? More real, you're talking from a Greek perspective? Why are they against Torah Mata? Yeah, Giddy.
I think they're against spirituality. They're against a connection to something higher than
okay, so maybe we'll get into that a little bit in a bit, but a little bit more than that, yeah? Okay, I mean, all the things you're saying is right. Maybe I'm on a fishing expedition here, but go ahead, yeah?
It's not a way of life. It's an idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
Based on rationality. Baruch Hashem, we're rational people. Yeah, no, I hear that. I hear that. Let's go. Just one more comment. Yeah.
Counterintuitive. Torah and Mada as a concept is somewhat.
What do the Greeks believe in? Mada.
Yeah.
Right. Meaning, you can have you want to have stuff in our library? Fabulous. You want to study your tradition? Great. Don't do it here at a base medrash, do it in the library. I mean, Greeks didn't want, what they didn't like is the Jews' special claim. Maybe this is what you're all saying. Jews make a special claim about our book. Greeks couldn't deal with that. The Greeks want to say, there is such a thing as wisdom. We happen to excel in it. Don't claim there's anything else. The Greeks couldn't deal with our claim to something beyond them. They're against Torah Mada because they believe in Mada only, not Torah. Assimilate anything you want into our Mada. That's fine. Bring your books into our library. That's fine. But don't claim that Torah gives you any kind of special status. Mm. Now the Greeks had, we kind of see that everything the Greeks did was l'shitasa, right? The Maharal brings up this interesting point that the Greeks didn't destroy the oil. They could have done that. What did they do instead? Pardon it? They were metame it. Can we have an English translation of that, please? Pardon? What? They rendered it impure, or they defiled it. Excellent. They rendered it impure, they defiled it. So why do they do that? Why don't they just burn it? So Maharal says, the reason they didn't burn it is because that's the whole way the Greeks approached things was embodied or distilled in this action. What's so unusual about Galus Yavan? In all the other exiles, what happened to the Beit HaMikdash? It's destroyed. During Galus Yavan, it's there. What's it filled with? Idols, let's say, to quote you guys from earlier. The idols to the valorization of, not God, but man. So you have the outer shell, but inside what is there? Greek. What about the oil? You have, they retain the outer shell of it. The external form is there still. It's just the internal aspect of it is gone. And so also, says the Maharal, that they left the external form of the Jew. Think back to the passage from the Mishnah Berurah we looked at, the Levush. They looked back at they left the external form of the Jew. What do to the inside? Take him out. Take it out. We understand the Or Gedaliah now, right? Or Gedaliah says that the Avera that the Greeks are associated with Shrichos Damim. What is Dam in the Torah? Dam is Nefesh. What did the Greeks do? They took the Nefesh out of the Jew. They left the external form. Left the external form of the oil. Left the external form of the temple. Left the external form of the Jew. They were Michalel it. What does it mean to Michalel? Think of Chilonim in this country, secular people. To render something Halal. What does that mean? To take out its inner, to render what's inside like a vacuum. That's what making something secular is, to take out its inner essence and to leave only its external form. So the Jews were fine. You want to celebrate Hanukkah? Fine, make a website for it. We have Kwanzaa, we have Christmas. Have all of these things together. But don't claim you're special.
Because by that claim to specialness, you're undermining our claim. Yeah.
Doesn't each religion think they're special, though? Why is it just Judaism? I mean, Christianity thinks they're special.
Yeah. I'm sure. I'm not really following the question. I mean, Enochanami. And so, how do we relate? So, what's the question?
Why specifically the Jews? Why are they? Mm. Other religions also.
So I mean, why do the Greeks take aim at the Jews? Uh-huh. And not, let's say, the Christians. It's a good question, although we may see the way in which Christians were... Let's just hold that question off for a second, and maybe we'll approach it. So the Jews, as long as they were part of everything else, and they didn't claim their particularity, was fine. I was asked to make special reference to this passage from Voltaire. So now you can tell your parents you went to a shiur on Hanukkah in which Paul and Voltaire were quoted. Paul writes, this is on the top of page 3, the Jews, united in their particularism, deserve to be punished. Voltaire, of course, was one of the most enlightened Europeans. What didn't he like about the Jews? I mean, here's part of your question already.
Yeah, we look different, right? I don't know. I mean, when I was at Columbia, people couldn't deal with anything that I was doing. And I started hearing the F word. Don't worry. What's the F word? Fundamentalist. Fanatic. Freak. Well, the freak, they had always called me that, right? Anyway, you know, wasn't bad enough that I was not showing up to the West End bar on Friday night. What was even worse is I started to look different. I was wearing a kippah. Started to wear nicer stuff. Sometimes wore my tzitzis out. And people would ask me, why do you look so different? Like Jews, we insist on looking different, eating different, going to different places, separating ourselves. Right? The Rav says in confrontation, right? And on the one hand, we go out to the world. We make an accommodation to the world. On the other hand, we're different. And our claims to particularism are very different than other cultures. And Christian claims, what does Paul say? Greek or Jew, and Jew is Greek. Everybody's the same. In a way, Paul is coming from a very Greek perspective.
Yeah. So, Jewish particularism is problematic. So, just as we kind of move to a conclusion and start to answer some of our questions, I wanted to think about really relying upon a mimer of Rav Huttner and Pachet Yitzchak of what the particular gezeras were of the Greeks against the Jews. What did they do? So, Rav Huttner learns the two brachos that we say when we're called to the Torah, Asher Bachar Banu, Asher Nasa Manu. Asher Bachar Banu has to do with Jewish practice. Asher Nasan Lanu has to do with, obviously, Torah. So what are the decrees or that the Greeks used against the Jews? You guys know this, right? Yeah. Shabbos, Bris, Milah, and Rosh Chodesh. Why? Why those? Why, especially given what we've set up until this point, why those things?
Given for the Torah.
Okay. Yeah.
It makes them different.
Ah, so how does it make us different?
We're taking days off, and we have a physical thing different than us.
So let's start with Bris Milah. Let's start with Milah. What does Milah do? How is this? How would Milah itself be something that would go against the sensibility of the Greeks? Why would they not like it? Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then also, they're making themselves different from birth. So already, they're becoming different.
So it's a way of distinguishing ourselves. And for the Greeks, of course, all there is body. And Milah says, I can take something that's physical, and what can I do with that physical thing? I can sanctify it, and I can render it holy. I can change it. Yeah, you want to say something?
Yes,
I'm going to
go to Rosh Chodesh.
So what, can we just wait on Rosh Chodesh?
Yeah.
Go for it, yeah.
Okay, fine.
You want to try Shabbos also? Go for it. Let's finish Milah. Yeah? All
right, so Milah, so Greece is all about like the wholeness and like keeping everything like clean and pure. So the fact that like we're putting a blemish on ourselves.
Right. So we distinguish ourselves and make ourselves holier through when in Greek eyes seems to be a kind of blemish, yeah.
The Gemara says that if a Jew keeps Shabbos, yeah, they're chayav misa. And also by, I think...
If a Greek keeps Shabbos, yeah. Or a non-Jew keeps Shabbos.
Non-Jew, sorry, yeah, my bad. You guys can keep
Shabbos. You can still keep on Rosh Hashanah. Keep on keeping Shabbos.
Yeah, and also by, I think by Rosh Chodesh also, yeah, he says a similar type.
Okay.
And also the Torah Mincha says that that the Mila is what gives the a Jewish person a Teretz Yisrael. And all these things also seem to make sense.
Okay, so this should all go against a Greek Hashgafa. Yeah, your comment?
Yeah, the verse is also a covenant between us and the child.
Okay, so really, it emphasizes our specialness, our particularity. So let's do Rosh. So Shabbos, what about Shabbos? What do the Greeks have against Shabbos? I mean, Shabbos is an oath, and through our keeping Shabbos, we testify that there's a creator of the heavens and the earth. So by Mila, we sanctify our body. With Shabbos, we're really sanctifying the world. We say the world itself is something that can be sanctified. I mean, I'm looking at Shabbos not temporally, but rather spatially, more having to do with the place than space, right? Really, Mila is on the body. Shabbos, this is also the Orgadalia. Shabbos is the place of the world. The Greeks would just say the place of the world is just this place. We say the place of the world is this place that was created by God. And now Rosh Chodesh. Now, what do we do on Rosh Chodesh? How does this fit as well? Okay.
They were about their calendars like this. They were solar calendar like this.
Okay. So you sound like a very advanced astronomer now. So.
We run a different calendar.
So it's different. But what else about it? Yeah.
All our holidays are based off of the calendar. Without the Kodesh, we don't have any.
So, how about you guys read Shakespeare in high school? Macbeth. You know Macbeth's famous speech: "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow." Can anybody recite it by heart?
Petty day.
Nobody? Yeah, you can do it? Pardon, you won't do that? You know, no command performances? Yeah, that's not the whole thing. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Right, Macbeth's view of time is the view of time of the Greeks. How is time structured? Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. There's actually T-shirts. They have them in America, but since the base medrash, I'll paraphrase it. Stuff happens, right? That's the Greek way of looking at the world, right? Meaningless time, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. That's it. I wish somebody would quote it by heart. I don't do Shakespeare. What do we do? I mean, you said, right, we sanctify time through the sanctification of the moon. Klal Yisrael has time in their hands, and through us, we render, as you said, right, we render time meaningful. We have the ability of sanctifying time. We sanctify the body, we sanctify place, and we sanctify time. Greeks can't deal with any of this, right? Because the Greeks just have a world of empty bodies. That's just all there is. The world is exhausted by its physicality. We claim that physicality itself can be elevated, can be rendered holy. Greeks don't like that. That's Asher Bacharbana. What about Asher Nasalman? What else did the Greeks say we shouldn't do?
Learn Torah.
Don't learn Torah. And they made it hard. Ptolemy, Greek king, who's also known as a cosmologist, right? Ptolemaic version of the universe is geocentric. Who comes and undermines the Ptolemaic view of the universe? Copernicus, which is heliocentric. But Ptolemy had other things doing. And one of the things he had doing is he wanted a translation of the Torah into... So he managed that. Forced, you know the story, put all the Sanhedrin in separate rooms, they miraculously came up with the same translation. What's the name of that translation? You guys are so Greek. It's the Targum Shivim or the Septuagint. What's hiding in that word Septuagint? The number 70. And we, 10 days or you know some days after Hanukkah, we actually fast. Why do we fast? Because we ate too many sufganiyot. Why do we fast? Because of this translation. I mean, it also is connected, as almost all the fasts are, with the liturgical cycle that leads up to Chorban Beit HaMikdash. But we fast because of the translation of the Torah into Greek. Why do we do that? Because we're neurotic. What do we have against, you know, translations? We don't like bookstores. We don't like Amazon.com. We don't like translations. You guys like translations? Can somebody pass me an art scroll? Oops. why don't we like translations? What's so problematic about the translation of the Torah into Greek that it merited not at the beginning one day of fasting, but rather 3 days of fasting? Why? Yeah. It removes us from the text. That's interesting. What do you mean by that?
Every word that we translate, it takes us a step further from it, from our Sinai. The Torah was given to us.
Uh-huh.
And in its purest form. And once you translate it, it removes that purity.
So it's like the Bill Murray movie, Lost in Translation? Not what you're saying, really. I mean, having said that, we know in the beginning of Dvarim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu commands Moses to translate the Torah into 70 languages. Svasema says, why? Because in later generations, people are going to need it, pass the art scroll, in order to come back to their tradition. Again, Chazal can't be put in sound bites. It's complex, although what you say is obviously true. It takes us away from Sinai, but maybe other things about what the Greeks in particular did. Yeah. Well, how do they do that? How do they do that? Uh-huh. I always thought we're the people of the book, aren't we? I mean, when I was growing up, we watched public television, the New York Channel 13. Is that still happening there now? Right? So I'm writing another book that I'm going to write. It's going to be called Lies That I Learned on Public Television. One of them is that the Jews are the people of the book. We're not the people of the book, are we? The Greeks turned us into the people of the book. They turned us into people of the book, something external to us. Really what I'm getting at, and I think maybe this is what you were saying actually before, is what's the difference between Torah in the Beis Medrash and Torah in a library? How is it different? How is the experience, that's what I'm really focusing on what you said, how is the experience of learning Torah in the Beis Medrash different from studying, well, what would I study in the library? What's the call number for, well, what would it be called in the library? Biblical studies. It might be called the Pentateuch. What else might it be called? Depends. Yeah. Old Testament. New Testament. Right? I mean, Old Testament only comes into existence with the New Testament, right? And if you go to the library, what's going to be next to it? Depends how big a library, right? Koran, Kwanzaa book, or whatever other books, whatever holy other books there are, you know, quote-unquote holy books. So how does that change things? Yeah.
You're actually internalizing it. Being part of your life.
Ah, right. And we're learning Torah Shabbat Peh, and it's part of our lives. And what the Greeks do is they make the Torah external to us. And they make it something that it's in the library. Svasema says it's something we gaze at it from the outside. It becomes external to us. So the Greeks didn't like the special claims that we were making to Torah. Medrash says that God hesitated to let Moses write down Torah Shebaal Peh. He was worried that one day some of the nations of the world would come along and say, Anu Yisrael, we are Israel. You really get a sense of the different exiles from this claim. Who says we are Israel? There are two different ways of saying it. One is what Christians say, or what the Romans said, really what the Christians said, or Americans say, City on the Hill, or English people said in the 17th century. We are Israel, we have come to replace them. There's one chosen people, it was the Jews, it's now us. That's the Anu Yisrael of the Medrash. That Anu Yisrael can't deal with the Beit HaMikdash standing. Has to be destroyed. Has to be. There's another Anu Yisrael. The Anu Yisrael of, there are no such thing as Jews and no such thing as Greeks. What is that Anu Yisrael? We're all Jews, we're all Greeks, we're all together, we're all special, we're all not special. It's the breaking down of distinction. That's the parameter of the Greek exile. We're all Israel. You think you're special. It's Oprah Winfrey. That's the Greeks. Nobody's special. You're all special. Everybody's special. There's nobody who's distinctive. And the Greeks wanted to, through challenging Jewish practice and challenging Jewish learning, to eliminate our claims to being special. So what do the Hanukkah lamps have to do with all of this? If you ask, let's bring in Aristotle to the base Medrash. If Aristotle comes in, will we stand for him? Yes, we will. We'll stand for Aristotle. If Aristotle comes into the Beis Medrash and we ask him, how many days will the oil burn for? What will he tell us? One day. If Newton comes into the Beis Medrash, we stand for him? We would. I'm speaking personally. I think it might be Psak. If he comes in, we ask him, how long will the oil burn for? One day. So what do they not understand? They see that all there is the physical, and that the laws of nature are absolute and finite, and that the Greek world defined as a world of physicality and bodies is absolute, and that the physical world is impervious to any forces from outside of it. In fact, there are no other sources outside of it. What do the lights of Hanukkah tell us? Even in the darkness of exile, even after Korban, even when there is no more Avoda, there's still the possibility of seeing light. In a period of darkness, there is also light. Why are the Hanukkah candles so chaviv to the Rambam? They're so chaviv because it's a way of not thinking Greek. Ner mitzvah Torah or. Ner mitzvah is physical. Through the physical, the or of Torah can come out. The Greeks negate that. The Greeks say all there is the physical. We say on Hanukkah, even when it's dark, and Galus Yavan, does it continue? Probably in this country in ways which are extraordinarily, emphatically, yes, it does continue. Even when people say all there is the physicality, and we're all the same, that light testifies to our particularity and to our ability to see. Is seeing believing? Now you get your chance to disagree with me. Are there going to be sufganiyot at the Chagigah? Yeah? So we're almost there. Is seeing believing?
No.
I mean, who am I if I say seeing is believing? I mean, you know, of course, you know, when you're a data processor or you're a doctor or you're a lawyer, you've got to process data and you've got to be an empiricist. But when it comes to seeing some things, you can't be a Greek. You've got to see like a Jew. It's interesting that Purim is about loving HaKadosh Baruch Hu even though I don't know. Hanukkah is about a refined kind of knowing, a refined way of seeing. Even in a world of darkness, I see. The last passage on the sheet of Hirsch says, the mitzvah of the Hanukkah menorah is renewed and brought into the Jewish home because the Beit HaMikdash is no longer that place of hold, that place where we can see the light of the Avodah. Where do we see the light? In the darkness of Galus, but in the light of our own homes. And that refined seeing on Hanukkah, in which seeing is not necessarily believing, but rather where believing is seeing. Aristotle and Newton can't do that. Where believing is seeing, that's what we take through us, through Hanukkah, and also through the rest of the year. Chag Sameach. Yeah.